invite my colleague Paul Alberts to do a response to this.
Okay, good evening, and thanks to David for a very, very stimulating talk. My role here is I just have a few minutes really to respond, and given the breadth of his talk, it would not be possible in a few minutes to embrace all of the different things that he talked about. Really, my job here is a sort of a foil to focus in on something, select a few themes, while you in the audience might start to think of questions of your own. And so my job is to sort of, as a sort of bridge to further conversation. Who do we think we are? A question that still animates philosophy and still carries the traces of Immanuel Kant's revolutionary reorientation. And knowledge of the world must take heed of its very positioning and its activity. As we come to know the world, we also posit it through our human understanding. And then this creature with understanding must itself be under question. Kant's form of the Copernican Revolution, which we often cite as a critical reorientation of the human, is reiterated anew today in critical environmental thought. Who do we think we are? David argues that our emerging character as a geological force over the Earth displaces human history. Our human time must be understood as a dwelling within nature, as one particular species' continuation. But one that is author of a spectacular and irreversible dynamic. The great movements and events of human history have, in fact, also been ecological events. The struggles of modernity for economic flourishing or democracy or forms of human justice have also been enfolded within trajectories of staggering population growths and hyperbolic energy consumption. We can no longer be defined as self-appointed and determined sovereigns standing apart from nature, surveying what we can take and use, but are instead co-dwellers with other living things, altering both their and our conditions. To know that, to engage in geological consciousness, as David calls it, is also to challenge orthodoxies, among the most important of which are the ways in which our current technological fixes on the natural world are valued as inevitable and necessary for our well-being. To take one line of such critical thought, that advanced and developing industrial economies should continue to expand commodity production through the same unsustainable material and energy pathways. That must now be one of the most questionable of contemporary value orientations. Living with the Earth cannot mean the same process of modernisation of the last two centuries is endlessly redeployed, and that narrowly defined economic values with Trump all others. Probably everyone in this room accepts the validity of that challenge, and that the future cannot be business as usual, expanding to embrace close to 10 billion humans by mid-century, most hoping to enjoy some version of the American or otherwise Western consumer good life. But this prevailing orthodoxy of expand as before and hope to clean up somehow after is, I want to argue, deeply systemic. By this I mean written into the ways research agendas are set. Development is procured, nation states set legal economic frameworks, production centres are established and re-established around the world, and finally into the ways in which the consumption patterns of urban populations to which we belong are daily reinforced. Our most common and everyday actions are woven into these causal chains. If we understand this view, then we also understand the systemic and dispersed character of responsibility and complicity, and the vanity of thinking we can find a clear and sufficient argument or arguments which might act as a powerful enough, almost magical, switch to reorient actions across vast and entrenched networks. Hence, reason will not be enough, I think David argues correctly. This seems an essential recognition. We know in increasing detail the problems. Not a day goes by without major announcements of environmental disaster, resource depletion or species extinction. We know, but knowledge is not effective in itself, is what I hear read him saying. Perhaps two decades ago, it was possible to imagine a short interregnum period was occurring between a state of relative ignorance amongst Western publics and the emergence, after increasing dissemination of accurate knowledge, of a new state of international resolve, a state of emergency responses, of covenants between nations. But after the failures of the Kyoto Protocol and the Bali, Copenhagen and Durban UNFCCC conferences, not only the ineffectiveness of disseminating scientific knowledge, but also the relative ease of mounting effective sceptical and spoiling campaigns has become clear. But further, we should understand the roots of scepticism are many and lie in deep-seated human orientations to life, which are often non-rational, emotional and affective. One of last year's most telling discussions of climate action impasse, the American George Marshall's book, Don't Even Think About It, Why We Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change, and I must say I don't agree with his framework all the time being a philosopher, but it gathers cognitive psychology and sociological research to show how climate change typically presents as an abnormal, difficult, distant, counterintuitive phenomena that cannot be easily grounded in interpretive communities, in the emotional bonds between people. While it fails to elicit vital positive emotions, matching poorly with social conformist habits, it readily elicits vague fears that are easier to avoid than affirm and provokes cognitive dissonance rather than resolve. Marshall's wide collection of evidence shows just how thoroughgoing is contemporary disavowal of climate change and environmental problems in general, to use a psychoanalytic term much used in contemporary philosophy. So many of us know but don't want to know, or wish to believe we act as best as we can, or say, but I am but one and the problem is massive, or know the problem but also know we cannot damage the economy by changing, etc., etc. Now, one of Marshall's most provocative suggestions is that given the many permutations of what I'd like to call systemic disavowal, we might seek to develop collectives and institutions that could, he argues, in effect, rival evangelical assemblies, or the intensity of denialist groups, or the conviction of neoliberal ideologues, and foster, in fact, shared beliefs that connect and affirm alternative actions more than just explain. This disturbingly yet timely message continues that we also now need to avoid destructive passions, guilt, dissonance, and blame emerging from beneath the avalanche of data. We need narratives that unite, convictions that achieve the status of shared common resolve. And as a secular-oriented Australian academic who mostly felt that accumulating scientific evidence was forceful enough, I could only read Marshall's views from the US with wide-eyed interest. So to enjoin with David's paper, the passions we might hope to develop positively in relation to nature, to animals, to life on the planet, can in part be thought of as paradoxically located in the question of what alternate human-to-human associations need to develop within and against systemic disavowal that dominates today. That humans will disavow difficult truths must be accepted. No magic truth serum can be dispensed, but how to in fact feel a way forward together that is not just shared gloomy knowledge is an important emphasis. I'd to underline that in 2015, as atmospheric CO2 crosses 403 parts per million, what can we do with such knowledge? To think geologically is perhaps in part to assert new forms of human commitment and association that must become increasingly possible for nature to recover from the anthropological machine that distances and objectifies. Nature is not to be preserved over there, but essentially in and through a renovated symbolic order, the shared fabrics of common human life. And so emergency measures today must be international, political, economic and technical, yes, but a politics of making human coexistence with non-human nature easier to share must be part of that project. Thank you.
Usually at this stage, I turn to David and ask him if he would like to respond to the respondent. But there was so much love and common ground here, I'm not sure whether you want to respond or add something or...
I can make a quick response.
Absolutely, that'll be good.
Am I wired? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so the subtitle to George Marshall's book, you know, Why Our Brains Won't Let Us Respond to Climate Change. When I hear, you know, Goering once said, or is said to have once said, that when I hear the word culture, I reach for my revolver. And when I hear the word brain, I feel very similar. Because we need brains. I mean, without them, where would we be? But they are being positioned in a way that I think is unfortunate. And really what I mean by that is this, that it's just not true that we always respond badly to bad news and that that mobilization is not possible. And, you know, Adam mentioned mobilization for war or mobilization for the security state after 9/11. I mean, this is very, very effective. So, you know, serious bad news can actually motivate people to do something about it. But we know perfectly well that the climate within which that bad news is received is not just a fact of nature. It's been very carefully constructed by oil companies and the way they've funded think tanks to produce the illusion of a debate about climate change. It's in that context, which is not about brains, it's about, you know, social organization and the distribution of money. It's in that context that the confusion and the difficulties about responding occurs. And if you want to look at we have a perfect historical analogy, which is tobacco. If you now look at what tobacco companies were doing, they were, you know, before... the question of whether tobacco causes cancer, I mean, it's a matter of scientific controversy. People are disagreeing all the time. And yet, you actually look at their emails, they knew they were lying. In other words, they set up this space in which there was apparently a disagreement about this. There wasn't a disagreement among scientists. It was a disagreement constructed by tobacco companies. The same is happening now. So all I want to say is that I don't really like the reference to brains, as it suggests that it's individual psychology that's going on here, whereas actually I think it's the kind of reigning narratives that are being constructed for us by rather powerful interests who have billions of dollars at stake in the outcome of this.
So we'll open now for questions from the floor. The way we'll work is there are two roaming microphones, Giovanna and Amy. So if someone wants to ask a question, put your hand up and the microphone will come to you, or Amy and Giovanna will bring the microphone. But also, we'll have to call it quits before 8 o'clock at about 10 to 8 because of security and reasons and so on and so forth. David.
Thanks for the amazing talk. Nietzsche said that the human animal learns nothing except through pain. So for the sort of changes you're talking about, I'm wondering how much pain do you think we might need to experience to change?
So before 9/11 happened, there was a rather nasty right-wing group that was thinking about how they could change the American psyche, attitude to the world such that it would realize the need for a much greater military presence in the world. And they said, we'll need something like a new Pearl Harbor for this to happen. And then 9/11 happened, and indeed this orientation, or this reorientation, actually happened. Now, it wasn't direct pain. It was the pain here was the shock to the sense of security. I mean, an absolutely clear example of a shock. And when we think about climate change, the problem is, I mean, I remember once watching this movie. It was a disaster movie about New York and the eastern seaboard being submerged in water. I've forgotten the name of the movie. The Day After Tomorrow, indeed, thank you. And I remember thinking, this is incredibly powerful, but the one thing that's wrong with it is that it looks just like a movie. And so it was possible to actually watch the storm raging through the window, as it were, and the window was the screen. And I guess that the problem with climate change is how you represent the pain, or how you bring it to, how you represent it, how you make it, give it an impact that isn't so tied up with the vehicle of the impact, as in this case a movie, that you don't really take it seriously. And every time we have a big storm, you know, it's easy to think, to confuse weather and climate and think, hey, you know, that's climate change, you know, that's what's going on. But that's not true. So I think that it is, the difficulty is precisely how you make present and viscerally engaging something that is many, you know, probably a couple of decades ahead in terms of its really catastrophic consequences. And that is a, you know, real question for all of us. I mean, I try and do art, and just to raise some sort of connection, more, a greater consciousness between terrestrial and cosmic phenomena, but it's terribly indirect, and there's not much pain there. It's quite a lot of pleasure.
And I think Jess?
Thank you very much. I'm Jessica White from the University of Western Sydney. I wanted to ask you about the way that you framed this heading into a world in which Enlightenment ideals of justice and equality may essentially be destroyed for us. And you made a comment at some point where you said something along the lines of, when it comes to what matters, the capacity to suffer, we're all in the same boat. And there's something that disturbs me about this comment and about some of the way that responses to climate change are configured, in so much as it seems to me that they coincide with a related trend about reconceptualizing the human that has been in train at least since the 1970s. And I'm talking about a certain response and antagonism to the anti-humanism of figures like Foucault that you spoke of, and the attempt to revive an idea of the human as what the new philosopher Glucksmann termed a being that is not made to suffer. And this trend was very much about displacing ideas of political transformation and ideas of challenge to a global economy with a humanitarian politics of protection, which asked for nothing more than simply the prevention of suffering. So I think my question is really what role you see for ideas of justice and equality in responses to climate change.
Well, I do have an answer to that. And I thought it was mine, and then until I read Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, and I realized that I'd been beaten to it by her. And this is my thought, I may repeat this on Friday, but I'll say it now, because if I didn't say it now, I won't be able to repeat it. And it's a very interesting sort of mixed thought, and it goes like this. That in the past, the ideals that we've had of peace and justice and enlightenment and so on have been ethical ideals or political ideals. They've been, you know, we could go on with our, you know, serfdom or whatever, but wouldn't it be nicer if we could actually create a society that was worthy of humanity? I don't think that's our situation anymore. It's about survival. And the wonderful thing is that I think that the only way we're going to survive as a species is by implementing what we thought of as utopian ideals. And that is incredibly exciting, because I think once you get it, once you realize that global justice really is a condition for our sustainability, and that global justice actually means what it says. It means not only, you know, fair distributions of pain and pleasure, but also rethinking the ways in which each society organizes itself in order to be more democratic and just and so on. This is incredibly exciting and also very scary, because there are alternatives, like, you know, the North Korea model, like, spreading. But I mean, if you think, hey, wait, it's either North Korea or social justice. You know, maybe even some of the more selfish people around might think, you know, maybe we should go for the social justice solution. So I think there's actually huge hope. I think it's double or quits, I mean, to put it crudely.
I think there was a question there.
Pat Hanley. I'm unhappy with the notion of, you know, in the tobacco industry case, leaving it just as it's in their interests to act in that corrupt way. I don't know why we take it that tobacco companies are any more corrupt than anyone else. And is there some way of looking at what they did more positively so that we can, in fact, somehow all act together?
Well, I think the more positive view is that they were looking after the interests of their shareholders.
Chris.
Hi, thanks for that. I just wanted to just ask a question about, at the start of the talk, you made a distinction between humans and animals, although you didn't really develop that distinction. You made a, you know, left it at a binomial classification and then you went on. And a lot of the talk actually seemed to erode the distinction between humans and animals. And the question, I suppose, repeated was, who do we think we are, which is not only an ontological distinction, it's a parent's admonishment. And this idea that what we do is under the intended moral lesson is to undermine human hubris, in a sense. And this, and I'm wondering that whether this is, first question is whether this is necessary to an environmental philosophy, that you, that this distinction is eroded, because the, there's, it's not obvious to me that that is a necessary part of it, even with... I'll just ask that question, actually. Sorry. I was going to get... that's just the start.
So the trouble with your question is that I'm tempted to respond in using language that I used in the interview with Joe, which is to say that I actually believe in human exceptionalism. I think we are exceptionally stupid, exceptionally short-sighted, but also... that's joking. No, it's not joking. But in other words, there's a whole lot more to it. And I do think that given the circumstances in which it is indeed human beings that are responsible for anthropogenic climate change, for climate change, it's our exceptional powers that are going to be called on to try to fix this. And so I don't think we're just like other non-human creatures. We share an extraordinary amount, but in a sense the onus is on us to realize the ingenuity and exceptional characteristics that we have. But that's not just technological invention. I mean, I'd love to see technological changes. I don't want sulfuric acid sprayed in the atmosphere to make everything dark, and I mean, that there are some crazy, crazy thoughts about geoengineering. But I do think that we have both technological capacities that we need to develop, like massive solar, you know, installations. I think, you know, Adam was mentioning 55 kilometers square in the middle of Australia of solar panels, and you've solved your energy problem. I mean, that's go forth and do it, but also the really hard and interesting thing are social transformations, and trying to address the habits. You know, the idea of these interwoven habits that we all have and share and want with the very problem that we're facing. So. I think it will take an exceptional leap of intelligence and of humility and of actually being able to, in some way, weaken the powers that maintain the status quo as they are now in order to bring about the kind of transformation that we need. So I want to sort of pursue the commonality between the human and the non-human really to an extraordinary extent. And then I want to say that there is a difference, there are many differences, but the one that is really central is a kind of responsibility that we have that no other creature on the planet has.
I was wondering whether I can take that up, because when I was listening to you, I hear you sort of trying to emphasize the difficulty in a very Derridean manner, the difficulty of drawing the distinction between the human and the animal. But then you went to do that geophenomenology, as you called it, of looking at particular emotions like wonder and deep curiosity, which he associated with the pursuit of passions like truth and delight, and also angst about knowing things that may happen in the future, or calculating about things that may happen in the future. And it just seemed to me that, you know, it's precisely that kind of... I'm playing the devil's advocate now, right? It's precisely this kind of phenomenological approach that is so anthropocentric, as Derrida himself showed us by reading Heidegger. So I found that kind of tension in your paper. On the one hand, you know, wanting to do away with the anthropocentric machine, but on the other hand, having recourse to a kind of vocabulary of phenomenology that seemed to me eminently anthropocentric. So I was wondering whether...
My answer is, if there were not a tension in my paper, I would have failed. I mean, I don't think we could possibly get away from this tension. I hope it's a productive tension. And I have to say, I think an awful lot of what people call anthropocentric is not anthropocentric, it's mammalocentric. And that what we are projecting is not what is specifically human, but what is specifically mammalian. And there, I think we do. I mean, we, you know, you look at... and look at a, you know, cat suckling its kittens, and you know exactly what's going on. That's not anthropocentric. That's mammalocentric. Yeah.
Thank you. That was very inspiring. I just have a question, and it troubles me sometimes that whenever we talk about what's happening at the moment with the human civilization, it's very much a very Western way of looking at the world. And that's sometimes I think maybe, and not only me, whatever I read, is that this model that we are following, maybe that's the problem, because the greed and the consumption that we are actually imposing not only on the Western developed world but on the developing countries, and that's actually going to create more problem. Because if we had the similar things just in Australia, America, that was okay. But now we have billions of people wanting the same thing. So when you say, who am I? I'm reminded of Kenopadesh, which is an Indian... it's an explanation of Vedas, and which says, who am I? And I'm just trying to think of, is there any room for any indigenous or non-Western way of looking at what problem we are facing at the moment, to try to find some way of dealing with it so that we come to terms with that everything cannot be fixed by technology. That's the point that I wanted to make.
So to the extent that my discourse is Western in its orientation, it's because the problem is Western in its origin. I mean, that's... The problem is that the United States has developed a standard of living and a lifestyle that it has projected throughout the world through movies and through other forms of media dissemination that is desired by so many other people. And they can't have it. They mustn't have it, because we would need four planets if China and India and Brazil, just to name three countries, all managed to bring their lifestyle and standard of living up to the Americans. It cannot happen. So part of what I'm saying is that the skewed nature of my thinking is coming out of the place where the problem has grown from. But the weird thing is that, as far as I can see, almost all indigenous societies are and have been sustainable. And, there were, when, you know, colonists came to this country, there were, you know, at least 400 different groups, even language groups, of Aboriginal people here who had been here 75,000 years. And it's quite a while. I think that they could have carried on for another 75,000 years. But we have changed all that. So in a sense, I'm saying that we are looking for models of sustainability that somehow can be arrived at continuously with a transformation of our existing, our Western lifestyles. And this is a massive challenge. And we can't simply return to tribal situations. But maybe we can learn something from the kinds of values that are embodied in those lives. I mean, this is not an answer to your question, but I'm trying to, in a sense, it's confessional in a way, because I'm saying that the Western orientation I completely agree with. But this is, in a sense, where the problem is coming from.
Well, maybe that's a good or a bad note. I'm not sure, a kind of pessimistic note, but end the evening, but. Not with the hope that more optimistic.
No, we can get more pessimistic.
Those may come on Wednesday and Friday, and I hope to see you all there. But please join me in thanking Professor David Wood and Paul as well for his response.